We stopped last time. I covered table 20, right? We were talking about the major uses of calcium ions in the body. And some pretty important things that calcium ions does, like allow the central nervous system and the muscular system to work. So not surprisingly, calcium ion levels in the blood are pretty rigidly controlled. Without calcium ion homeostasis, you die pretty quickly. And there are a few major chemicals that control the blood levels of calcium ions. And that's what slide 21 is all about. What you see up here is the small intestine at the top, or a cartoon representing it. The small intestine, of course, is where dietary calcium ions are first introduced into the body. So the calcium that is in the food that we eat eventually makes it into our body from the small intestine. The lumen of the small intestine is, of course, outside of our body. We're wrapped around that tube. To get it into our body, it needs to be absorbed. And we really don't do a very good job of absorbing calcium from the food we eat. A lot of it is just passed through the feces. And in fact, we do an utterly bad job at absorbing calcium ions in the absence of calcitriol, which is listed up there as next to the arrow showing an inward flow of calcium into the body. So that's one of the three chemicals, calcitriol. Calcitriol is the name for the active form of vitamin D. Now, vitamins in general get their name from the fact that they're vital. They're things that we need, but they are things that we can't make on our own. Except vitamin D, we actually can make on our own to a certain extent, as long as we have adequate sunlight hitting our body, which is no problem around here. But it is still classified as a vitamin because we either have to make our own, involving some structures that I'll talk about in a little bit, or we have to take it in the diet. But if there is adequate calcitriol, then that allows for the intestinal absorption of calcium. And even then, a lot of it is wasted, as I say, it passes right through us. But that's why calcitriol is listed as the primary hormone or substance in control of absorption of calcium from the diet. The other two important chemicals are parathyroid hormone, which is what PTH stands for, and calcitonin. Well, I guess I should have said the other chemicals, because calcitonin, as it turns out, isn't really too important, at least for adult humans. It does, though, exercise some control over calcium ion blood level balance. All right, more about that in a minute. So the ECF, of course, is the extracellular fluid, and that's where calcium makes its way into from the small intestine under the control of calcitriol. The bone of the skeleton is a huge reservoir for calcium because, as I said last time, the stuff that makes bone hard is hydroxyapatite, which is one form of calcium phosphate. It's hydrated calcium phosphate. So hydroxyapatite has a bunch of calcium locked up in it. That allows the bones to be hard, which of course is good for the bones, which is why vitamin D is good for the bones, because it allows that calcium to come in to build that hydroxyapatite, especially when you're growing a skeleton. But the skeleton also is a place where if the body needs more calcium ions and you're not getting any from the diet, they can be gotten from the skeleton. So that's one of the reasons why the skeleton is a dynamic structure. It's always changing. You're building new bone and tearing old bone down all the time. Okay? So that's why bone is shown with arrows going into and out of it. Calcium can be deposited into the skeleton. Also, calcium can be drawn from that reservoir, which is the hydroxyapatite of the bone. And parathyroid hormone, and to a lesser degree, calcitriol, are responsible for bringing calcium from the bone back into the blood. That's why that's with that arrow. Calcitonin is important in a growing human, so not an adult, for depositing, helping to deposit calcium in the bone, taking it out of the blood, putting it into the bone. Okay? But calcitonin can easily be lived without. So that's why I said, compared to these other two, it's of minor importance as far as calcium homeostasis is concerned. Okay. Now the kidney is also involved because the kidney, of course, is a site of filtration, and filtration includes filtration of various minerals, including calcium ions. So calcium ions can be lost not only in the feces, but in the urine, but parathyroid hormone and calcitonin affect how much is actually lost in the urine, because these two chemicals operate on the kidney to determine whether or not any of that stuff is reabsorbed. The kidney does three major functions, basically. Filtration, which is just squeezing anything that's small enough to get through the holes in the capillaries inside the kidney, squeeze it out. That includes good stuff. So the second major function is reabsorption. The good things that get filtered out need to be brought back into the blood. And that can be adjusted hormonally, including calcium ions. And then the third major function of kidneys is secretion. Things that aren't filtered to begin with but need to be gotten out of the kidney are actively pumped the other way, secreted out of the blood and into the urine. So there's an adjustment of calcium ion levels in the blood at the kidney as well. So parathyroid hormone is by far the most important of these three chemicals. Parathyroid hormone, not surprisingly, is manufactured and secreted by the parathyroid glands. And you can't live without those because it's such a big deal to keep your calcium ion levels regulated. And so you can read this table on slide 22 for yourself, but let's look at the parathyroid glands. They have nothing to do with the thyroid hormones, but the glands are called parathyroid because they are located, in humans at least, right next to the thyroid gland. In fact, attached to it, but as totally separate glands. So if you look at a rear view, posterior view of the thyroid gland, which is what you're seeing in slide 23, you can see that the thyroid gland, shown in that tannish color, wraps partially but not completely around the back of the trachea. And that's where you'll find situated on the surface of the thyroid gland the four parathyroid glands. Now it's four usually. In most people it's four and they occur as two pairs, but there is some variance in that. Not everyone is alike. But the usual case is that there's these four small parathyroid glands on the surface of the thyroid gland, and for something so small, they do a really important job. That's what makes parathyroid hormone, PTH. Slide 24 shows you, by the way, the action of the cells that are responsible for getting calcium out of the bone and putting it into the blood. I don't know whether you've learned the three types of cells in histology, but there are three groups of cells. Those are blasts, cytes, and clasts. Have you ever heard these words? A blast is a cell whose job it is to create extracellular matrix. So the stuff that occurs outside of cells, that has to be manufactured by cells because it takes a cell to build stuff. So there are various kinds of blasts. In bone, those would be called osteoblasts, because osteo means bone. So osteoblasts are in charge of producing new bone material, new hydroxyapatite. That's when you're building up a bone. osteocytes, or sites in general, are responsible, cells that are responsible for just maintaining that extracellular matrix. And clasts, well, sites are really just mature blasts. Once there's enough extracellular matrix, you change the name of the blast to site. But clasts are entirely different kinds of cells. Clasts are in charge of degrading or breaking down extracellular matrix. So they do the opposite job of a blast. And you see an osteoclast right here. This is a clast that is in bone, or that's whose job it is to break down bone. So the bone matrix is the bottom of this figure, and this large multinucleate cell, unusual, most cells only have one nucleus, but there are some that have none and some that have many. An osteoclast has several nuclei and also has several little finger-like projections, cell processes on its surface that increases the surface area between the osteoclast and the bone surface. And that's because the job of this osteoclast is to enzymatically degrade the stuff of the bone, which is where the calcium is. All right? So enzymes and hydrogen ions, which is acidity, dissolve the bone and free up that calcium, which is then put into the bloodstream. Now, it's parathyroid hormone that increases osteoclast activity, which means that parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium ion levels, and therefore parathyroid hormone should be secreted in greater abundance from the parathyroid glands when calcium ion levels in the blood are low, lower than they should be compared to set point. Now the other important one of the three is calcitriol, which is vitamin D, as I said. You can just take vitamin D, as many of you do, no doubt. That kind of skips the steps involved in making your own. But if you are going to make your own, and you do, whether you want to or not, obviously, unless you live in a mine shaft, sunlight striking your skin converts a cholesterol derivative that is called cholecalciferol into another intermediate, whose name is not important to know, but it turns it into adds a hydroxide, which makes it an alcohol. Okay? Makes it a single alcohol. That then travels to the liver, where the liver transforms it into another substance, another intermediate, by making it a double alcohol, adds another hydroxyl group. And so that intermediate gets the name calcidiol, which is, I'm only giving you that name so that you make sense of the word calcitriol. Calcidiol, the diol means two alcohols. Okay? And then that travels to the kidney, and it transforms that into calcitriol by adding on a third hydroxyl group. So that's why it's calcitriol is the pronunciation and not calcitriol. It's calcitriol because it's a triple alcohol. Anyway, once that happens, then this whole schematic in slide 26 explains this. Once you have calcitriol, the active form, then it travels throughout the body as any hormone would and reaches the small intestine, which is its principal target tissue, and that's where, as I said, it allows for the absorption through the intestinal epithelium of dietary calcium. Okay? But it also, as you saw in that original schematic that I started with today, it also has some effect on the bone and the distal nephron of the kidney. So that's why calcitriol was listed at those places. But parathyroid hormone exercises much greater control. By the way, notice that parathyroid hormone is listed in here, and that increased plasma calcium ion levels, because more is coming in through the intestines, for instance, that increase in blood calcium ion levels will serve as a negative feedback to tone down the level of parathyroid hormone. So even though there is calcitonin, which works in the opposite direction, calcitonin you can kind of think of as meaning that it tones down the blood calcium ion level, so it decreases it. It really isn't equal antagonistic control. You can completely eliminate calcitriol from the picture, and parathyroid hormone alone will still tonically, homeostatically adjust the calcium ion levels. Just by parathyroid hormone level going down, that will allow for blood calcium ion levels to come back down to normal. Okay? Because that will decrease the activity of osteoclasts. And it will also, by the way, as you see on the plus sign coming from parathyroid hormone, parathyroid hormone is permissive for calcitriol because it basically controls whether the kidney does or does not go through that final step of turning calcidiol into calcitriol. Okay? So if parathyroid hormone turns off the production of calcitriol, then that is another layer of control that's being added. So calcitonin might be much more important in other animals, but in humans at least, we're not even sure how important it is in growing kids, but it likely is a lot more important in growing kids because even though you still, as a kid, of course, have to have enough calcium for your nervous system and muscular system to work, it's also important to make sure you empty the blood of enough calcium to keep up with your growing skeleton. That calcium has to come from somewhere. So that's why calcitonin probably not only important in kids, but why a lot of calcium in the diet is so important in kids. Okay? That vitamin D is important in growing kids. It doesn't have to come from milk, but it has to come from somewhere. Nothing against milk. I just thought I'd add that. All right, that's that chapter, which means I only have to get through just actually some of chapter 22 before you're rid of me for the semester. This first slide in chapter 2 is this pretty cool figure of showing all these pools. The diet brings in actually all four of the macromolecule classes, of course, but three of those four are really considered the nutrient classes. We don't really rely too much on nucleic acids for our energy. We need it for our RNA and our DNA. But fats, carbohydrates, and proteins all can be used for fuel to make eventually ATP. But as you see centrally placed here, glucose is the most important of those. Glucose not only is central in this picture, it's central as the biochemical pathway is concerned. And the other pathways connect to this central glycolytic pathway. Well, what you have here is this main glucose pool right in the middle. That glucose pool represents the glucose that's in the body at any given moment. And the normal range is shown in red here. So glucose, we've already talked about in the last semester, glucose has a fair amount of chemicals adjusting its levels, so it's pretty tightly controlled as well, which makes sense because, as I said, it's the fuel for the nervous system. But it can go up and down within this normal range. Notice that if it gets below that bottom range, then the only thing that's really allowed to have it is the brain. See, the only pipe that it can spill through once it gets to a low level is the brain. That's what that's trying to represent. If it gets too high, then it starts overflowing and going into the urine, maybe. But that is not even colored, because it has to, that almost never happens in a normal human. And that's because even though glucose readily is filtered by the kidney, just about all the glucose that's in your blood goes out into the filtrate, which is what that stuff is called before it's actually processed into urine. Almost all, well, effectively all of it gets reabsorbed at the kidney. So under normal circumstances, for a non-diabetic, all of that glucose comes back into the blood. But if you can still have too high a level, and it would notice goes up into that glycogenesis pipe. Glycogenesis refers to creation of glycogen. Okay, genesis means creation. So there's four words that are confusable here. Glycogenesis refers to making glycogen out of glucose. Glucose is a monosaccharide, and it is just a monomer of the polymer that is glycogen. Glycogen is nothing but glucose, but it's a bunch of them strung together into one molecule. That's how we store our glucose. As I said before, plants do it as starch or as cellulose. Same stuff, though. Glucose at the heart of it. And there's two major places where that happens. The liver makes a bunch of glycogen, and the skeletal muscles make a bunch of glycogen. So that's important to make glycogen, not only because it's a more compact way of storing this sugar, but because it takes it out of the blood. You don't want the glucose level in the blood to be too high or too low. Right? So the extra glucose that's there, which is right after a meal when you're absorbing all this glucose into your body, the blood level spikes. It's important then to take that extra glucose out of the system, but you don't want to waste it, which is why it's not put into the urine. Instead, you string it together and make glycogen. All right, now, glycogenolysis is the word that means the breakdown of glycogen. Okay, lysis is splitting. So glycogenolysis happens when blood glucose levels fall again. In other words, when you have too much glucose after a meal, you make the polymer glucose. After you've been fasting for a while and the blood glucose levels dip, then you take that stored glycogen and split it back down into its original glucose. That is glycogenolysis. And that's why the pipe comes back into the glucose pool. And so the liver undergoes glycogenolysis and spills that glucose back into the bloodstream so that the brain can still live. The other confusing similar word is gluconeogenesis. The neo means new. So gluconeogenesis literally means creating new glucose. That by new, it means creating glucose out of something that wasn't glucose to begin with. Because when you have glycogen and make it into glucose, well, glycogen is really just glucose anyway. But the liver is able to transform non-glucose things into glucose. So it can take amino acids or lipids, since they all are basically carbon skeletons anyway. They're all organic compounds. It can turn those non-glucose substrates into glucose. And that is what is gluconeogenesis, which will also happen if glucose levels get too low. That's why the gluconeogenesis tube is coming from the amino acid pool, because you can use amino acids to do that. And then, of course, the fourth confusable term is glycolysis. Glycolysis is splitting of the glucose molecule. And that is what's happening in all of your cells. Glucose is the primary fuel for all cells of the body. But glycolysis splits glucose into two pyruvate molecules. And this is all 188 stuff, right? That pyruvate then, in the presence of oxygen, then can go through the citric acid cycle and the electron transport chain and oxidative phosphorylation to get you the maximum number of ATPs out of that glucose that you can get. And what does that leave? If you completely break down glucose as much as you can to get as much energy out of it as you can, what's left over? Carbon dioxide, right? That one carbon in carbon dioxide is one of six that was originally in glucose. Okay. Fats, by the way, which are lipids, all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. But fats are the mostly what you take in your body in lipid form. And fats are triglycerides. So even though fats aren't technically polymers, they are macromolecules that are made up of smaller parts. And those smaller parts are free fatty acids and glycerol. So a single glycerol with three fatty acids attached to it is a triglyceride. That's why it's called a triglyceride. And that's what fats are. So fats can be broken down into free fatty acids and glycerol, and then those can feed through the system in various ways as well, is what you see here. The word lipogenesis refers to creating lipids, and as the name implies. All right. Slide 2 shows you much the same information. This just shows you that glucose is the most important of those three nutrient classes. It's the central pathway, this glycolytic pathway that leads to the rest of it, which will happen in the presence of oxygen. That is the core of everything. And these other, the pathways involving amino acids and lipids feed into this glycolytic pathway at one place or another. This third slide shows you that not only is glucose tightly controlled because it has so many important hormones involved, but two hormones that is really the main topic of this final chapter I'm going to be talking about, exercise really tight control. Those two hormones are called insulin and glucagon. These are both pancreatic hormones, but they act antagonistically, and the reason that they're able to exercise such tight control over blood glucose levels is because the interconversion between glucose and glycogen, which can go either way. You can go from glucose to glycogen, that's glycogenesis, or you can go from glycogen to glucose, that's glycogenolysis. Those two directions of the same reaction are catalyzed by two different enzymes, which doesn't have to be the case. Most enzymes can work in reverse, forward or reverse. But this is an example of one that has two different enzymes, and each enzyme is controlled by its own hormone. So the enzymes 1 and 2 are the ones we're talking about here. If there's equal amounts of glucagon and insulin, then you're not favoring glycogenesis or glycogenolysis, right? It's equal directions. But part B of this, it happens in what is called the absorptive state, which some books will call the fed state. You're in your absorptive state after a meal when you are absorbing things through your intestinal epithelium. You're bringing stuff into your body during the absorptive state. And when that happens, because a lot of what you're absorbing is glucose, your blood glucose levels rise fairly dramatically, given that it's supposed to be very tightly controlled. Well, when that happens, though, insulin is released from the pancreas. And when there's more insulin than glucagon, that means there's more activity of enzyme 1 than enzyme 2. And enzyme 1 is the one that favors the transformation of glucose into glycogen. So that's one thing that insulin does. It tells the liver, primarily, but other structures as well, that glucose should be convert it into glycogen. There's too much glucose right now. We don't want to waste it, but let's store it as glycogen, get it out of the blood. Later on, after hours of fasting, the blood glucose level drops again, and that's when the pancreas starts secreting more glucagon than insulin. And so now glucagon abundance activates enzyme 2 more than enzyme 1. That favors the reverse reaction, which is glycogenolysis. Breaks that stored glucose that you made during the absorptive period back into glucose. And that period after the absorptive state is the post-absorptive state. Or some books will call it the fasting state. Or unfed, maybe. I'm not even going to say anything about slide 4, so skip that. It's really more about the digestive system than it is about what we're talking about here. Slide 5, though, shows you some important structures that deal with glucose in various ways. The brain, of course, is here because, as I've said several times, the brain can only use two fuels, and it's usually, under almost all circumstances, using only one of those, and that's glucose, which is why there are so many hormones devoted to making sure that the blood glucose levels are correct. Insulin and glucagon are the primary ones. They directly do that job. The stress hormones do that and other things as well. The other thing that the brain can eat, by the way, are ketone bodies, as I said, which happens when fatty acids are metabolized. But ketone bodies are never in great abundance in the body unless you are in a starvation state. But anyway, the liver is shown here because the liver does a lot of important stuff in the body. But nutrient interconversion is one of its jobs. Nutrient interconversion means taking one nutrient and converting it into another. That, when we're talking about making glucose, is gluconeogenesis. But it also undergoes glycogenolysis and glycogenesis. So the liver is one of the important things responsible for taking that extra glucose out of the blood during the absorptive state, making it into glycogen. Then it waits around until it drops again and splits that glycogen back down into glucose and puts it back into the blood. The adipocytes are the cells that make up adipose tissue, and adipocytes are really just balls of fat. Notice that the blue nucleus in that cell, because it's a living cell, so it has a nucleus, it's really just pushed to the side. The main job of this thing is just to be a chamber of fat, which is important because lipids are a really efficient way of storing energy, meaning that per mass, lipids have more energy in them than any other nutrient. More than double the amount of energy is locked up in a gram of fat than is found in a gram of carbohydrate or protein. So if we stored extra energy in the form of protein or carbohydrate, which we don't do very much, I mean, we store some glycogen, but not all that much, just for hours worth. We store fat. There's enough energy in fat for days worth of not eating. If we were to store that, though, as protein or carbohydrate, we would weigh a lot more than we do, which would be counterproductive. Then we would require more energy to move around. But anyway, we make fat if we have even more of this glucose than we need to just make as much glycogen as we can make. So we don't keep making glycogen after a certain point. We have a glycogen store. When the glycogen stores are full to capacity in the liver and in the skeletal muscles, then the rest of that extra glucose we still don't waste because we've evolved to say food is precious, which it has been evolutionarily. It's not so much now. But that extra glucose is then converted by the liver into fatty acids, which are stored in adipocytes. All right? But the adipocytes are storing that first, not only for energy reasons, it's also important to have fat for padding and for thermal insulation. But when it comes time, if the glycogen stores are depleted, which they will be if you just simply fast for enough hours within a day, the glycogen in your skeletal muscles and your liver basically falls to zero. And then the only place that there is immediate glucose is your blood. That's going to start dipping. When that happens, fat is burned, fat is converted into glucose so that your brain can survive. Which is why when you starve yourself to having no fat, then you're really in trouble. Right? That's when you start dying. And the muscle, deltoid muscle is shown here as an example of skeletal muscle, because skeletal muscles also are a primary site of glycogenesis. Skeletal muscles take glucose into themselves, and then as soon as they, if there's more than they need, they make glycogen as well. That glycogen is usually just for the muscles. So the muscles don't act the same way as the liver does, meaning that they don't break down their glycogen and release the glucose in normal circumstances like the liver does. But they store glycogen for themselves because the skeletal muscles are among the most metabolically active tissues. So they need a lot of glucose because they need a lot of ATP to operate. All right, well, here's a look at the pancreas, slide 6. In case you don't know where your pancreas is, it's embedded in a hairpin loop of the duodenum, which is the first part of your small intestine. That's right where the stomach leads to the small intestine. And the pancreas is both an exocrine and an endocrine gland, meaning that it is partly ducted. That's what exocrine glands are. They produce secretions released through ducts to surfaces. That exocrine function is digestive. So the pancreas makes what is called pancreatic juice, which is delivered into the duodenum, which is why it's situated there. And that's for digestion. That's not what we're talking about here. But another part of the pancreas is endocrine, which means it releases signals into the bloodstream. Endocrine glands release hormones. And those, if you look at the histology of the pancreas in the lower left here, you'll see that there are a few different kinds of cells, at least three that I'm going to mention here. There are alpha cells, D cells, some book calls them delta cells, and beta cells. Now the D cells or delta cells secrete somatostatin, which is exactly the same stuff that we talked about elsewhere. What is somatostatin? Growth hormone? No, growth hormone is somatotropin. Right, growth hormone inhibiting hormone is somatostatin. Where is that released from, other than the pancreas? The hypothalamus, good. So I'm not going to talk more about this somatostatin, which basically keeps the alpha and the beta cells in check. But it is the same substance, and that's why it's still here called somatostatin. The two important ones as far as glucose metabolism is concerned, or glucose homeostasis, are the alpha cells and the beta cells. And all three of these kind of cells are clustered into little individual clusters within the overall pancreas, and those clusters are called islets. Islets of Langerhans is the eponym, but they are called pancreatic islets because they are little islands surrounded by the exocrine portion that produces the pancreatic juice. All right? Well, beta cells are the ones that secrete insulin, and they are in greatest abundance. So most of the islets are made up of beta cells. I mean, most of the stuff of each islet is beta cells. And anyone have an idea why it's called insulin? What does the word insular mean? I-N-S-U-L-A-R. It's an adjective that means what? It means of an island. To insulate something is to cut it off from the surroundings, to make it into an island, in other words. So that's why insulin gets its name, because it's produced by these little islets. Well, anyway, it's the beta cells that do that, and they are in greatest abundance. The alpha cells are the ones that secrete glucagon, and these work opposite to each other. Now, glucagon is kind of released continuously. Insulin, I mean, it goes up and down in its level, but insulin is much more, has a much higher dynamic range as far as how much is released. It can spike and then dip much more greatly than glucagon. Slide 7 gives you an idea of the antagonistic action of these two hormones. So when insulin is in greater supply, that means that insulin is in exercising its control more than glucagon is. So you really do have both of these things in your bloodstream at the same time, which are fighting against each other, but whichever one is in greater abundance wins out, basically. So the ratio of the two is really what's important here. And when you have insulin in greater supply, that's because you are in the fed state or the absorptive state. Now, the reason that the pancreas knows when to release insulin is that the pancreatic cells are able to directly sense the glucose concentration in the blood. There is neural input as well, so the nervous system can have its say and adjust it. But even without any neural input, the cells of the pancreas know when the blood glucose level is high enough to release more insulin. In the post-absorptive state, you have glucagon winning out, still some insulin around, but much more glucagon. And that's because it can also measure when it's low. What are the major effects of insulin? That's what's shown in the box here. Well, it increases glucose oxidation. Oxidation refers to burning that glucose for fuel. So when there's plenty, it's safe to go ahead and use it. Now, the brain has to use it all the time, but when there's plenty, it's safe to say the rest of the body can use glucose as well. Go ahead. It also causes glycogen synthesis, which is glycogenesis, and that's because you have plenty. You just don't want to burn all of it for the sake of burning it. You want to store it. It increases fat synthesis because fat can be made out of glucose, and it increases protein synthesis because you can also interconvert things into amino acids and then make protein. On the other hand, when it's sparse when it starts going down in the bloodstream in the post-absorptive state, glucagon is winning out. It's produced in greater abundance. And that leads to increased glycogenolysis, so you're breaking down the stores of glycogen so that you can put it into the bloodstream again. Gluconeogenesis at the liver, making new glucose, and increased ketogenesis. And that is because, remember I said that ketone bodies are a byproduct of lipid metabolism. And what's not listed here is that glucagon also basically tells the rest of the body, other than the nervous system, to use fat preferentially. You burn the fat when there's not that much glucose, save the glucose for the brain. And the burning of the fat not only allows the rest of the body to have fat as a fuel, but as a byproduct, it produces ketone bodies, which the brain actually even does better on than glucose. But it's never a hell of a lot of ketone bodies in a normal situation. Go ahead. You talking about ketone bodies themselves? If we have so many that we go into ketoacidosis, that's bad. Because, yeah, ketones will eventually acidify the blood. And you never want that to happen, because whenever you mess with pH, you change the conformation of a bunch of proteins. So your enzymes don't do as well, all your proteins don't do as good a job. But that's a really extreme condition. That's what I'm saying. You don't really produce many ketone bodies normally, and therefore they're burned by the brain. They don't really have a chance to affect pH much. this table in slide 8 shows you what happens to these nutrients in the fed state. We've already said some of this, but let's quickly go through this. In the fed state, in the absorptive state, there's plenty of carbohydrates, so a lot of them are used immediately, just burned, those oxidized, through aerobic metabolism. And that will create carbon dioxide out of them. Some of them are used for lipoprotein synthesis in the liver. Now, there's different kinds of proteins. Some of them are pure proteins. Some of them are lipoproteins, which are part protein and part lipid. The liver does a lot of manufacturing of these various kinds of proteins. The proteins that circulate in your bloodstream, the plasma proteins, are made by your liver, for instance. So the liver's busy doing a lot of important stuff, which is why it's so hard to live without one. Also stored as glycogen in the liver and muscle, as I've said, excess is converted to fat and stored in adipose tissue. That's when you have filled your glycogen stores. When you make as much glycogen as the liver and the muscles can hold, the rest of it goes to fat, which is why, even though the candy manufacturers like to say fat-free product when it's pure sugar, it will lead to fat in you, because if you already have enough sugar, you're going to make that into adipose tissue. Proteins, which are absorbed primarily as amino acids, meaning they come into the body through the gut as amino acids. You have to digest them down to their monomers, which are amino acids. Those come into the body, and those mostly are saved. You don't really normally want to use your amino acids for fuel, because they're necessary to make all the various proteins that all of your cells need, because the proteins do just about everything in your cells, as I've said. Well, you're always breaking down old proteins, having them build new ones. So that's what amino acids are usually used for. But if they are needed for energy, it's good to have a liver to be able to convert those amino acids into glucose, which by gluconeogenesis. Also, just parts of them can feed into the pathway at various parts. You don't have to undergo gluconeogenesis. Certain amino acids feed directly into the pathway, like into the Krebs cycle, for instance, and can continue it happening. But you can also, if you have nothing but a protein in your diet, you know, there's only so much that you need to build your proteins. There's only so many amino acids that you need to build your proteins. So excess amino acids can also turn into fat. The fats themselves, as I said, most dietary fats are triglycerides, and those are, if you don't need immediate fuel, which you don't usually when you're eating fats, they're just stored in the liver and in adipose tissue for use later. Okay, I'm not going to read you the insulin table, but slide 10 gives you three graphs of concentrations of these three chemicals. In the middle is the glucose concentration. And notice that the vertical dashed lines represent meal events. This person happens to eat three times a day. And so, not surprisingly, the glucose concentration in blue goes up after each meal. But notice it's staying within that normal range most of the time, because all it has to do is be within that normal range to be homeostatic. It still does, though, spike. And notice that the insulin concentration on the bottom pretty much mirrors the glucose concentration, meaning that it goes in the same direction and at the same time. As glucose rises, insulin rises. And that's because the job of insulin is to decrease glucose level in the blood. Whereas glucagon on the top, even though it does go up and down a little bit, and it doesn't change very much. That's what I meant when I said that glucagon levels are much more steady in the blood. Plasma goes up and down, but that drastic up and down of, I mean, insulin goes up and down, but that drastic up and down of insulin, while glucagon stays fairly steady, can cause differences in the ratio of glucagon and insulin. That's what that teeter-totter was all about. Also notice, though, that when it does change, it changes as a mirror image of glucose. When glucose goes up, glucagon goes down, and vice versa. Well, how does it actually work, insulin, that is? That's what slide 11 is all about. This is showing you the mechanism by which insulin works on most tissues. Now, insulin doesn't affect everything. Most notably, the nervous system, almost all of the nervous system, doesn't require insulin at all. Now, why does that make sense? It makes sense because the job of insulin, as I've been saying, is to decrease blood glucose. But it doesn't decrease blood glucose by eliminating that glucose. It does it by putting it into the cells of the body. In fact, it does it by allowing the cells of the body to transport that glucose into themselves from the blood. Well, you wouldn't want to at all impede the ability of neurons to take in glucose, which is the only thing that they can live on other than ketone bodies. Right? So neurons can freely take in glucose from the blood without the help of insulin. Other tissues don't have a mechanism for transporting transporting glucose into themselves unless insulin is around. All right? And that's what's shown here. There's a couple kinds of glucose transporters. One of them is GLUT4. And the GLUT4 transporter allows for transport of glucose into the cell through the plasma membrane. But that GLUT4 transporter isn't always there in the membrane. If it's not in the membrane, but rather it is a protein after all, this GLUT4 transporter, like all transporters are proteins. If instead of being embedded into the membrane, it is inside the cytoplasm, then it's not doing its job of transporting, right? So insulin controls that. And the mechanism by which insulin controls this is, since insulin is an amino acid-based hormone, it binds to a surface receptor. Insulin itself doesn't enter the cells because it can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. So it binds to a surface receptor that's called a tyrosine kinase receptor. The reason it's a tyrosine kinase is because it involves tyrosine, the amino acid. The reason it's called a kinase is because it is a class of special enzymes known as kinases, which get their name because they phosphorylate other molecules, which can be other enzymes. So kinases, by phosphorylating other things, can activate or inactivate other things. So this thing is not only a receptor, its outside surface is a receptor, can receive insulin. Its intracellular surface is the enzyme part of it. That's why you see at number 2 here, IRS, which stands for insulin receptor substrate, being phosphorylated. It's getting turned into IRS with a P on it. That's what phosphorylation is. Hook a phosphate onto it. Well, when that's phosphorylated, then that is an activated insulin receptor substrate, and then that causes second messenger pathways to be activated, which affects the transport activity at GLUT4. In other words, without insulin, glucose doesn't come into this cell. So this is not a neuron. Neurons don't need insulin for their GLUT transporters to work. All right, slide 12 shows you an adipose or muscle cell, and we see the same kind of insulin receptors as we just saw, but this just shows you that without insulin, which is what you see here, no insulin is bound to that insulin receptor, these GLUT4 receptors aren't actually part of the plasma membrane. They are stored as vesicles. Okay, vesicles are made up of phospholipids, just like plasma membrane is, but vesicles are entirely within the cell. So it's not that these muscle and adipose cells manufacture brand new GLUT4 receptors each meal. It's just that they take the existing GLUT4 receptors out of the plasma membrane so they're no longer gates through which glucose can travel. When insulin does come around, though, the second messenger pathway that's invoked causes exocytosis. Exocytosis causes these vesicles to re-merge with the overall plasma membrane. It kind of melts into it, since it's made of the same stuff, and that embeds those GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane, and therefore they can transport glucose into the cell. That's appropriate when insulin is around, because insulin is around when glucose levels in the blood are high. And so taking glucose out of the blood, putting them into these muscle or fat cells, is a way to reduce the glucose level in the blood back to normal levels. Things are a little bit different in a liver cell, though, which is shown in 13. They do have insulin receptors, but liver cells, or hepatocytes, use a slightly different kind of glucose transporter, GLUT2, which are always there. Okay, so liver cells don't directly need insulin for glucose to enter their cells either. But insulin still affects the transport of glucose through the plasma membrane of a liver cell. And here's why. When glucose levels are high in the blood, that's when it would be appropriate for there to be an intake into the liver cells. Well, that will happen whether there's insulin around or not. But with insulin there, the binding of that insulin will invoke a signal cascade which allows for the conversion of that incoming glucose, which would be coming in anyway because of the concentration gradient. That incoming glucose is phosphorylated, turning it into glucose-6-phosphate. Glucose-6-phosphate just refers to the fact that the sixth carbon in glucose is phosphorylated. That's why it gets the name glucose-6-phosphate. Well, glucose-6-phosphate is still glucose as long as you dephosphorylate it later, but it is, when it is glucose-6-phosphate, it is different from glucose as far as gradients are concerned. In other words, when you convert this incoming glucose into something slightly different, it's like eliminating glucose as far as the gradient is concerned, so it maintains the steepness of the gradient, which means even more can keep coming in because you're not building up any on the inside. You're turning it into glucose-6-phosphate. Does that make sense? And that's what insulin allows for. So it really makes the liver much more efficient at the transport of glucose into the liver cell, even though it would go into the liver cell even if insulin were not around. But the important reason why these different transporters are there always is because liver is the important two-way street as far as glucose is concerned. In other words, it needs to also easily be able to release glucose. Okay? Now, when does it want to release glucose? When blood glucose levels are low, right? When blood glucose levels are low, insulin levels are low. So if it were just like an adipose cell or a muscle cell, low insulin levels would mean that it wouldn't have any transporters in its membrane and therefore wouldn't be able to release that glucose the other way back into the blood, because glucose can't get in or out if there's no transporter there. That's why those GLUT2 transporters are always there, so that when insulin levels are low, glucagon levels are high, and the liver needs to release the glucose, it can do so through these ever-present transporters into the blood. All right, slide 14 just illustrates this in schematic form. So you have an increase of plasma glucose at the top acting as a stimulus. Notice that stimulates the beta cells, that's the plus sign, which makes sense because the beta cells are the ones that secrete insulin. Simultaneously, a high level of plasma glucose inhibits the alpha cells, which are responsible for producing glucagon. So glucagon levels drop, insulin level goes up, but insulin level goes up more than glucagon drops. Anyway, that causes more insulin to be released. It has its effect on the liver, muscle, adipose, and other tissues as we've described. But the effect of all that, of course, is increased glycolysis, tells the cells it's okay to burn glucose, increased glycogenesis by both the liver and the muscle cells, use the extra as storage, in other words, increased lipogenesis, use the extra as making fat, and increased glucose transport as well. Well, the effect of that is to take all of this glucose that you're using for these various purposes out of the blood, which decreases the plasma glucose, which is exactly negative feedback as far as the original stimulus is concerned. An increase in blood glucose leads to a decrease in blood glucose. But it has to be self-checked, of course. So blood plasma glucose gets too low, then negative feedback operates on the beta cells, since they are directly able to sense that blood glucose level to begin with. And therefore, things will reverse. The beta cells get inhibited, and the alpha cells will become non-inhibited, produce a little bit more glucose, insulin level drops, and you don't keep taking glucose out of the blood, and the brain can still survive. All right, I'm not going to read the glucagon table to you either, but there is a corresponding schematic on slide 16 for glucagon. I don't think there's any new information here, but notice that, I guess maybe there is a little bit of new information. The muscle and adipose tissue, in response to a decrease in insulin and increase in glucagon, produce lactate, pyruvate, and amino acids. Now, why lactate and pyruvate? Where do those come from? Yeah, those come from glycolysis, exactly. Pyruvate comes directly from glycolysis. Pyruvate is a 3-carbon sugar that you split the 6-carbon sugar glucose into 2 pyruvates. That's what glycolysis is. Normally, those pyruvates would go on through the oxidative pathway in the presence of oxygen to fully break it down to CO2 and get you as much ATP as possible. Under anaerobic conditions, fermentation yields lactic acid or lactate. So that's where that's coming from. And those things can be sent to the liver, fatty acids as well, because the liver is the main nutrient interconverter, as I said. So you have glycogenolysis. That's appropriate because your blood glucose level is low. Gluconeogenesis, also appropriate. Ketone bodies come from the fact that these fatty acids are metabolized by the liver. And all of that, I mean, those ketones can be used by the brain. The blood gets refilled with glucose, but only up to a certain point, of course, because then there's going to be negative feedback at the pancreas again. So remember, all of this, which is itself tight control of blood glucose is still being affected by the other hormones we talked about last time. I don't think I even want to bother with slide 17. I'm not saying it's not important. It's just, it's stuff I've already talked about. I think you should look at it, but I'm not going to talk about it unless you want me to. Does anyone want me to? Why is that always a no? The only thing I really want to say about diabetes, I mean, other than, well, what I want to say about diabetes is that there's two types, of course. You probably already know this. There's type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And type 1 diabetes, which older books will call juvenile diabetes, that is an autoimmune disorder, which is why it occurs in juveniles, usually. Something goes wrong in which the pancreas is, instead of being recognized as a person's own tissue, becomes recognized as foreign tissue. So those beta cells, which are responsible for making insulin, are actually destroyed by that person's own immune system. And that's why that person becomes unable to make its own insulin. And of course, that's a bad deal because there's no more control of blood glucose. Now, it's not nearly as big a deal as it was, I mean, as far as immediate life-threatening situation is as it was historically before we figured out how to deal with it at least somewhat, but it is still a huge deal and becoming even more important in the United States, especially for the fact that there's the other kind of diabetes, which is adult onset diabetes, type 2 diabetes, which is associated with obesity. That's not because of an autoimmune disorder. We actually don't know fully the reasons why this happens, but there's diet is definitely part of it, and that's why it's epidemic in the United States. But it's also partly a reason of ethnicity. Anyway, either kind of diabetes is an inability to control glucose levels in the blood. And the word diabetes, by the way, means to flow through, indicating the fact that the full name of diabetes is diabetes mellitus. The diabetes part of that means flow through, meaning that there is a lot of urination. And the mellitus means honey, like in the word mellifluous, meaning flowing like honey. And that's because there's so much glucose in the blood, since it can't be taken out of the blood and put into the cells without insulin, that extra glucose stays in the urine, and the urine has a honey taste for a diabetic. It used to be common to taste urine for various reasons, medical reasons. That's not so much done anymore, but except recreationally. But all, like I said, all, your glucose is filtered by the kidney anyway. But remember what I said about any process that requires a transporter. This is not just in the kidney. This is any process that requires a transporter, like facilitated diffusion, for instance. Those processes exhibit competition, specificity, and saturation, right? Saturation refers to the fact that there's only so many transporters to go around. If you're trying to transport more particles than there are transporters, some of those particles are going to be out of luck and be left out. So in a normal situation, all of our glucose gets filtered at the kidneys, but all of it comes back in because we have enough transporters to go around for the number of glucose molecules that are in normal blood. In a diabetic, though, there is a lot more glucose there because you can't spill it into the cells without insulin. And therefore, it does get filtered because that doesn't involve transporters. That's just hydrostatic pressure squeezing it out of the glomeruli in the kidneys. That's just blood pressure squeezing it out. It tries to come back in, and some does, but only as many molecules as there are transporters per moment can get back in. There's a lot more still in that filtrate that gets washed away in the urine. That's why it's called diabetes mellitus. And so that's why you see right here that the plasma glucose level is much higher in a diabetic subject. It doesn't come back down simply because it's not being put into the cells of the body since there's no insulin. Yeah. There can be several ways, things that can go wrong with type 2. It can be a decrease in the release of insulin for one reason or another, which we don't fully understand. It can also be something that goes wrong with the ability of cells to respond to insulin. So it can be desensitization, or it can be cutting off supply. And we don't know fully why either one of those happens and what all it has to do with diet, but it certainly is involved. It also can be genetic, just later, there can be a genetic disposition for it, is what I should say. But it's a different genetic disposition compared to the one that leads to the autoimmune type 1. All right, the rest of this chapter is about heat And I only included it in case I got really fast and had some time to talk about this, since it's directly what I did for my PhD, but it's not really what I wanted to talk about anyway. So we're done. You're done with me.